The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The big word in the lead headline in the Wall Street Journal today, crisis. Crisis on Wall Street. The markets have been on fire for weeks now and not in a good direction. Nobody knows what's coming next, but suddenly there's a harsh, bright light on where we've just been. Too much lending, too fast and loose, bubble country. A new novel based on the insights of an unlikely Wall Street insider tells the story of the age of hedge funds and private equity and the billion-dollar games that traders play. Up next, On Point, wild days in the markets and the confessions of a Wall Street shoeshine boy. Joining me first today from New York is Doug Stumpf, editor at Vanity Fair. He struck up a relationship with a real shoeshine guy and began researching a book on Wall Street's latest go-go era, interviewing traders and bankers and reporters. The result is his first novel, Confessions of a Wall Street Shoeshine Boy. Doug Stumpf, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me here.
So who's this guy that you use as your way in? This is not exactly a factual story, but you've built it on a whole pile of anecdotes that your shoeshine guy shared with you. Who is he?
Yeah, well, I was a book editor for 15 years, and 11 years ago, about 12 years ago, I went to work at Vanity Fair, and at that time, we were in the old building over on 350 Madison. And there was a shoe repair shop right around the corner. It's right around the corner from the Yale Club and Grand Central Stations. And we all went to get our shoes shined there. And there was this really adorable kid. He was only 17 at the time, who was working there, this Brazilian kid. He was having a lot of trouble adjusting to the culture. And he really reached out to all of us. So we all kind of took him under our wing, you know, and I had a lot of sports tickets in those days. I had a Knicks subscription. You know, I don't know if you've ever had a Knicks subscription, but
no.
You get enough tickets to go every night of the week if you wanted. So I had a lot of free tickets to give away. And so we just became really good friends, you know. He's just a cool kid. And then I lost touch with him. We moved across town to the new building. And one time I stopped by the store to see if he was still there. And they said, no, he has a new job on Wall Street. And I said, wow. And then just by coincidence, a couple weeks later, I ran into him in Times Square and he said, well, you know, I got my new job is shining shoes at a Wall Street firm. And I didn't realize that, but all the big Wall Street firms, the big financial firms have their own shoeshine guys. And these guys go around the trading floor and, you know, they go, shoeshine, you need a shoeshine to each of the, you know, these banks are huge.
Got to be shiny. Don't have time to go down to the shoeshine shop.
Exactly. And that's a good gig for a shoeshine guy because they tip big and, you know, you're dealing with the same customers day after day. So I met him on Times Square, a junior, he's known on the floor, and I said, let's go in and, you know, tell me some of the stories. And he started telling me these crazy stories. And I said, man, I got to do something with this. I got to write some of these down. And even then, I didn't really do much. And but we, you know, we struck up our friendship again. He became my Knicks partner. And one day I was in Graydon Carter's office. Graydon is I'm sure everybody knows, the editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. And I said, you know, Graydon, there's this kid that I've been talking to who's shining shoes on Wall Street. And he's just telling me these crazy stories. And Graydon goes, oh, my God, what a great idea for a movie. And he started writing it down. I said, wait. I think I'm going to
step back. Step away from the plot line, the treatment.
And so then I did. You know, we got together once a week for the next 3 years. And I tape recorded. I probably have a couple hundred hours of him on tape. One of the things that really appealed to me, besides the stories, is he has his language is Portuguese, but he's a talker. So when in English and he doesn't have to say something, he just drives around it somehow. You know, he has
freestyle.
This wonderful musical speech.
Yeah. We're going to hear from the Shoeshine Boy. The book's titled Shoeshine Guy at this point, and hear directly from him in something about the time that he spent on the floor of that big Wall Street firm, which shall go kind of unnamed. I mean, you know a good story when you see it. You've edited a lot of David Halberstam, John Krakauer, Michael Chabon.
Six of David's books.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not as though you haven't had your oar in deep water. Tell us a little about the story that you pulled out of the anecdotes and observations of the guy who was seeing this, you know, from the shoeshine kit up. Give us the flavor of the story you've brought to us, Doug.
Well, you know, when I first started out, I thought I just wanted to show this great character. He has a great sense of humor. And the thing about I think the trading floor is this incredible society that if you're not in it, you don't know what it is. It's this pressure cooker. It's this kind of testosterone-driven bubble. It's like no place else, you know. It's this drive to make money. It's always to make more money. And there's all this kind of crazy humor there and not always so politically correct. And what interests me about using this kid, this Brazilian kid, is that he doesn't really understand about the numbers or what they're doing there. That's all stripped away. So he only sees the human values. He sees this guy is greedy or this guy is mean or, you know, or this guy's a nice guy or this guy's cheating on his wife. So I thought, you know, a lot of Americans you start talking about things like subprime mortgages and derivatives and, you know, eyes glaze over and people don't really understand Wall Street. So I thought this is an observer who takes away all those fancy terms and the numbers and he sees the culture for the kind of, you know, a Darwinian jungle that it is, but all with this great sense of humor. I mean, I really wanted to write a funny book. That was one of my main objectives.
Yeah, it is funny, but it gets to a very, very rough patch where a whole lot of money is on the line, and a lot of Americans are feeling that right now. I mean, you take us in here, you've got this big-time trader, Steed, by name, who gets in trouble, who ends up gone, ends up
heading at
a hedge fund, of course. Everybody wants to go today. Persimmons,
I wish you'd
read a little
so
bit
much
for
money.
Us.
Yeah, okay.
There's a lot of
young guys... Oops.
Well, I'm only pushing because we're coming to a break, and I'd like you to read before we get there. Don't we need to hit the clock? There's a piece on page 173 where you can set it up for us. But here it gives us a sense of how some hedge fund guys may be feeling today as we speak.
Yeah, well, this guy, he's talking about a colleague of his, Cantone, you know, who's left the big firm. And a lot of young guys want to leave the big firms because they can make so much more at the hedge funds. You know, the hedge funds take much riskier bets. That's what we're talking about, this big crisis today. And, you know, they can earn so much more there. And they don't have to deal with this kind of, you know, bureaucratic structure that you get at the big firms. So So he's talking about this guy Cantone. He's saying there's a couple of years when he reshot the lights out, did particularly well with Korean equities. So he's still working at the big firm. They promoted him to managing director, and he was running that entire side of the business. But then one day, about 2 years ago, he went to Bigelow, that's the CEO, and announced he's going to start his own global macro fund. I think he started out with $125 million or something, which is not much for that kind of thing, but he was doing pretty well there for a while. And then the journalist says, well, didn't I read in the journal, though, that he ran into a rough patch about 6 months ago? And the guy, he says, worse than that, word was he was facing a huge margin call. Dead man walking, investors stampeding for the door. I think they were mostly funds of funds, which panic at the first sign of trouble. So he was down something like 40%, and he had a lot of expenses, high rent in a fancy building, dozen employees, Barbie doll second wife spending his money faster than he made it, the works. So he had a nervous breakdown, locked himself in his office with piles of newspapers and magazines and research, and nobody could get him to come out for a month except to take delivery of pastrami and rye.
That's
the kind of craziness.
Yeah, reading from his new book, Confessions of a Wall Street Shoeshine Boy, and we can imagine hedge fund managers hunkered down just like that. Today, Doug Stumpf's Confessions of a Wall Street Shoeshine Boy takes us right in there. We're going to hear more about this story, but with Wall Street so hot, Doug, we want to keep it live in our ear at the same time if we can today. Right now, also joining us from New York is Robin Farzad. He covers Wall Street for Business Week magazine. Robin, thanks for being here.
Hey, Tom.
So we have been watching as Wall Street's been shaking. You know, is an era ending here? Are people hunkering down, hoping to make more of those billions on the other side? Doug Stumpf takes us inside where the money gets high and sometimes people get really hunkered down and in trouble. Is that where a lot of guys are today?
You know, Tom, it's been whiplashingly painful in the past month for some of these hedge fund masters of the universe who just as recently as mid-July, were at the top of their gains. We're seeing some of the most respected quantitative hedge funds, the most feared arbitrageurs who can charge the highest premium product to get out there.
The quants, with their quantitative analysis of everything, it's supposed to be unbeatable.
Unbeatable. They have these black boxes, but like HAL in 2001, right, A Space right. Odyssey, the machine is always fallible. And so we're seeing enormous pain, some of them confessing as much as 20% losses in 1 month. And suddenly they don't look as immortal as they appeared in June.
It was awfully high living until very, very recently. Doug Stumpf, how does this big shake on Wall Street work for your book? I mean, are these high times behind us now, or are you showing what's really been going on?
We have some new intelligence even because my shoeshine guy is still on the trading floor. And he was there last week and a couple of the traders were talking to him and they said this week is going to be the week when it really all comes apart. Really, really gets crazy. I mean, you had Bernanke last week. Everybody was trying to get on, you know, saying, oh, it's not so bad. The markets are – they were trying to calm the markets. But the traders on the floor are saying this week is going to be pretty crazy.
So the fear fever running in the shoeshine guy's world these days pretty high.
That's what he says.
But, you know, that's what these guys are all in with their wives, with their jobs, with their bets. So inevitably they want to, you know, push the very bleeding edge of the strategy. And, of course, it's going to come back to haunt them. But many of them realize they'll live to see another day.
If they've got enough socked away that they can be reborn into the next bull market or the next part of this one.
Right.
The thing I like about this subprime mortgage is that everybody understands it. That because people understand mortgages and they understand these banks were lending to people that they had no business lending to, and that's why it's coming apart.
Sheila's on the line from Boston. Hi, Sheila. You're on the air.
Tom, how are you doing?
Pretty good. What do you know?
Well, I used to work for one of these guys.
One of these guys, masters of the universe type guys?
And that's exactly the phrase. I'm not a quant. I'm totally qualitative, but they were all quants. The black box, all of these terms are so familiar, and I remember the day the shoeshine guy came in and was shining the shoes of one of these 20-something guys, because this was a firm that had been set up by a bunch of young men who had left other more prestigious, stable firms, shall we say.
Out to make their own millions. Yeah. And how did it look to you, Sheila? Did it look like this was built to last? This is a good leading edge of the economy or, you know, sort of wild and crazy and watch out?
Both, in the sense that this is a whole generation of people in their late 20s at that time. This is about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was clear that they weren't going any place but up. It was a question of who was going to be able to hang on long enough to survive. But you have to understand that some of these guys are really very smart, quantitatively very astute. And, you know, they use computers and the whole thing. But it is a very strange world of very hyped-up males, very few women in the groups, lots of money being spent in interesting ways, shall we say. And also, I don't know if Doug includes any of this in his book. He may not have heard about this through his informant. But they've got a whole new twist on the uses of philanthropy. It's like doing business by other means.
Yeah, we talked to Tom Wolfe about that a couple of months ago. Doug, how about it? Sheila's teasing us on a lot of fronts there, on the maleness, on how money spent in interesting ways.
Well, we have the philanthropy angle because we have that hedge fund trader is basically gives a bunch of money to a charity, but he says on the condition that a certain hedge fund that they invested in a certain hedge fund, which is absolutely legal, believe it or not.
So here's my gift. Invest it in my company. And, of course, I get a cut of that real quick.
Yeah, exactly.
How about on the testosterone front, on the free-flowing big money and where it goes front? Give us some of what you learned.
Well, it certainly is testosterone-driven, and one of the early reviewers sort of accused me of being sexist in the review, and the truth is Wall Street is pretty sexist. So I actually toned that down quite a bit for the book. There was stuff that I just felt, you know, I was trying to write a funny book that was just too egregious to put in, but it certainly reflected a lot in the book.
And of course, you've got your man Steed finding his maybe his one true love. It's a Russian girl in a strip club where no small amount of money gets spent. Part of what may lead to his downfall.
Yeah, that's actually a story I heard not from the Shoeshine Boy, but from another Wall Street trader who just told me that story. Something very similar to that. I want to emphasize that the book is fiction and the characters are all created, but it's very authentic.
Robin, let me go to you on how those masters of the universe are feeling this week. You know, the quants and everybody else are taking their hits. Give us a taste of that. And does the hedge fund bandwagon survive this rock and roll moment?
Well, there's an interesting sense out there that all of these guys, if you want to talk about testosterone, at this point in time, they feel as though everybody's holding everybody else by a certain appendage. You don't know what everybody else owns. And if they liquidate a position, that forces you to mark something to market. I don't want to get too jargony here. Mm-hmm. But these guys, by and large, are so interconnected because so many of the strategies of the past 5 years were ones that were pounced on en masse by the entire street with the help of leverage and derivatives. Mm-hmm. And it's so difficult for an individual firm to extricate itself, to cordon itself off and say, we have our own strategy and counterparty X, Y, and Z across the street has nothing to do with us. These guys tend to move increasingly in unison. But it must be said that in times like these, some of the most astute hedge funds are the ones that crave these opportunities. A lot of them sprung out of the ooze that was the dot-com meltdown and the technology meltdown because they, in sophisticated ways, bet against many of the tech and telecom companies that ended up failing. And they made a killing and parlayed that into the mortgage boom and the real estate boom with newfangled securities. And I guarantee you that out of the dead wood that emerges from this conflagration, whatever metaphor you want to use, some even stronger hedge funds are going to emerge.
So, but right now, even the quants who are supposed to have their computers figuring out how to win even when everybody's losing, even some of the most famous of them, have got it in a ringer. James Simons at Renaissance Equities, $29 billion fund, down 8.7% as of the end of last week. This is a guy who made $1.7 billion last year. He's been bringing home 30% returns for four years, and even he in trouble right now, Robin.
That is probably the most single admired hedge fund in the world, actually. I think rumor has it, you know, there is very little transparency here that they can charge their investors 50% of upside and 5% out of the gate. It's invitation only. It's closed off to new investors. The guy never offers interviews. He only hires the most rarefied PhDs. But let's keep in mind what happened in 1998. That's when I myself started working on a trading floor and had my baptism by fire when long-term capital management blew up. And these were the smartest quants, the smartest PhDs. They thought they had the market perfectly straddled, and they almost took down the entire global economy. Alan Greenspan had to intervene, and the New York Fed had to bring bankers together to carefully step backwards and disentangle this mess. So even the smartest people fail.
Doug, you know, Joe Kennedy famously got out of the market in 29 when he heard the Shoeshine Boy was getting in. Now, you bring that whole Shoeshine Boy metaphor, and more than a metaphor, a real person, and we'll hear from him back here. Is he the canary in the coal mine? Is there a moral sort of bottom to this story? Or do you have to have a black box computer quant mind to understand what's going on?
Well, I think he doesn't – there's no moral judgments that he makes. He just shows the mindset that can get you into this trouble. I mean, if you're reducing it to its simplest thing, it's if you're always trying to earn more money, you're always going to take greater risks. And at a certain point, the risks, you know, crash in on you. I think what people are saying today is more in trouble than the hedge funds are going to be the private equity firms, which are really depend on credit to close the deals to take over these big companies. KKR, I heard, has something like 119 deals that haven't been done. And with credit tightening, it's going to be very difficult to get those deals done.
In a credit crunch, it's hard to keep buying on the big leverage, buying with the big borrowing, and flipping that stuff over. Let's get another voice here from New York and the world that's rocking this week. John is on the phone. We can't use his last name, but he's a trader with a big New York financial firm. In fact, works for the firm, loosely fictionalized in Doug Stump's book. And he's one of the Shoeshine Guy's customers. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
How are you feeling this week? Are you keeping your stomach, keeping your wits about you?
Yeah, we are. You know, we're confident that the market's going to balance itself out, and the Fed will step in if they need be. But we're confident things will work their way out.
Now, you've got to say that, don't you? Because that keeps all of us from jumping ship and leaving you holding the bag.
That's exactly right. We don't want to create panic here. We have a lot of customers who are concerned right now, clients. And you saw it last week with the volatility in the market. But we think this week we're going to get some words from Ben Bernanke, and I think everyone will calm down a bit.
John, take us back to last week when it was really shaking down there. I mean, just how white did your knuckles and those of your colleagues get?
Well, certainly. I mean, you saw it on both the equities and the bonds. I focused primarily on the bond market, and we saw just a total credit crunch. But like I said before, I think it was just a slight overreaction, and we'll get back on a steady course here.
It's been a pretty good run since the bubble burst in 2000. Have you ever been through a major correction, through well, call it whatever you want. Have you ever been through anything like we're going through right now, John?
No, I mean, after 9/11, you saw the same high volatility in the market, but the Fed did a great job in stepping in and creating liquidity. And I think that's what's going to happen again.
And if they don't?
If they don't, hold on. It could get a little ugly, but we don't think it's going to get there.
What happens to your world, the world of traders? I mean, like, have you looked at your window to see if it opens? How wide is the ledge? What floor are you on?
It depends on how things play out. You might see some turnover in the banks. Everyone's really putting their head down, working hard, because they know, you know, if banks see... if banks start losing some money, no position is secure. So everyone's keeping their head down, working hard.
And what about the premise of Doug Stump's book, that the premise and the fact that the Shoeshine Boy has been listening? Did you ever think?
Yeah, Doug. Let me say here that John is a lovely, lovely guy who is one of the traders that treats Junior just, you know, super. And he is the one guy we gave the book to read in the galley form.
Yeah.
So he read the early version of it.
All right. So from the horse's mouth, John, does Doug catch it like it is? The sex, the drugs, the insider trading, the cell phone in the utility closet.
Everything is spot on. It's funny. I've been working at a bulge bracket firm now for a number of years. I have a brother who's in the market. He's been at another top tier bank for years. And Confessions of Wall Street Shoeshine Boy is certainly creating a buzz on the street, but It's just the detail, everything, the sex, the drugs, scandal, as you said, it's all priceless because it's so accurate.
And the party goes on. Are you so sure? All those kids out there headed back to school in college thinking about being iBankers, is this still the way to go, John?
I think so. I mean, there's money to be made. They pay a good price. And when you have all that, power comes along with it. And it takes a book like this to really, you sit back and you look at it through the eyes of someone like Gil in the book, and it
Shoeshine
really
guy, yeah.
Yeah, it brings, you know, brings you back down to reality, and you say, you know, this kid's here. You might not recognize that he is there all the time, but he witnesses it, and it really brings you back to reality.
A real human being who's really paying attention from his vantage point. John, good luck. I guess God help you and us all.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Robin Farzad, is that a stiff upper lip we're hearing, or do you hear a lot of that confidence that Ben Bernanke's going to save the day here?
You know, a lot of these guys have such nostalgia for Alan Greenspan and the Greenspan put, the idea that the guy would come in and bail you out. But that kind of moral hazard, a lot of very smart market watchers are careful to not ascribe that to Mr. Bernanke, who is a target-oriented person. He keeps his eyes on inflation. He doesn't want to get off on the same foot that Alan Greenspan did, what with the 87 crash. And every time the traders could go in and take disproportionate bets and realize that it's just an asymmetric dynamic here that I could just go out there, gorge on whatever I do, take on leverage. And in the end, the worst thing that can happen is things fall apart, but the Fed chairman bails me out. And I don't believe that Mr. Bernanke is going to be of that cloth.
We saw $30 billion plus unleashed on Friday to staunch the bleeding. Is that it, are you saying?
Well, you had it on the brink of turning into a true crisis where really no one was trusting anyone else in terms of credit. There was a logjam into the Holland Tunnel. So he came in there and became a counterparty, just a temporary counterparty. But he didn't open the true preferred spigot, which is the discount window and cutting the Fed funds rate.
That's what everybody's
pining for. And, you know, they're most likely going to be disappointed unless things get a lot worse.
Boy, but you can hear John waiting for it. Let's take a call from Alberto in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alberto, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm so glad I can finally speak to any of you guys. Although I'm not going to bring any excitement on your show, unfortunately, because all I am really is somebody who doesn't know anything about financing. As a matter of fact, I'm one of the victims. And the reason why I'm calling, because I'm tremendously unhappy and angry at what's been happening in the past 2 months.
How are you a victim, Alberto?
How am I a victim? For my 401k, there are $2,000 lost in 2 months. How can this be possible? And I feel like so vulnerable. I have no idea of what's going on, who is managing my money. Maybe the same people that voted for Bush will never put my money in the hands of anybody.
Alberto, $2,000, that's lunch money for these guys.
Oh, okay, listen to me. I am just a poor guy. I'm just somebody who is trying to safeguard my 401k that one day is going to be lost if I keep on going this way.
I've got a note here that says you've got a friend in the business, or who was in the business.
A friend is somebody that my wife knows. It's a family. You know, Armani is in the Washoba, that's what we call it, right? The Washoba Finance.
No names, please. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, what's the story?
The story was that we took the money away from one place to put it in another place, hoping to gain a few bucks. The reason is we gained very little in a few years, and we lost more than a little in a very few days. I have a million questions for you, but I'm not going to take any of your precious time. So all I'm asking you is how can we be guarding with these guys who lunch they're playing with my lunch money.
Alberto, okay, Robin Farzad, what's the word? Alberto has lost $2,000 and it's killing him. For the little folks out there who aren't spending $2,000 for lunch, What to do right now?
The guys on Wall Street really do not care about the little guy, more so than ever. When I was there 9 years ago, it was about the high net worth investor who had at least $10 million to put in and the institutional investor. And it's been multiplied in terms of the upward limits of the lower limits that are allowed. And now they're looking at hedge funds that want to bring in at least $100 million. So a person like Alberto, the best you could ever hope to do is to be in low-cost indexes. Because think about it. The market, the U.S. market is corrected, 6-7% at most from its July high? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're sitting here crying uncle. This is nothing like 1998. This is nothing like 2002 or the week after 9/11 when the market finally opened up. And you know what? Things are bound to fall apart on occasion. We're just coming off the longest stretch in a big chunk of history when we did not have a 10% correction in the market. The market went on for 4 years without correcting 10%, and we still haven't seen that yet for all of the consternation over the goings-on of the past 2 weeks.
We've been joined by Robin Farzad, covers Wall Street for Business Week magazine, been watching all the goings-on of recent days right there. And with us, Doug Stumpf, an editor at Vanity Fair, debut novelist. His new novel getting a lot of attention, especially as Wall Street rocks a little bit. It's called Confessions of a Wall Street Shoeshine Boy, and it is quite a yarn of all the doings there, heard from sort of the floor level up, from the perspective of a real shoeshine guy who he came to know very well, who shares his stories, and Doug then embroiders them right up for us in the book, we have the shoeshine guy himself with us right now from New York. In the book, he's Aguilar Gil. He's called by the traders in the big firm where he works. With us, he goes by Murillo, or Junior, he favors. Shoeshine worker for a major Wall Street firm on the trading floor. That's a fact. Doug Stump's book loosely fictionalizes his life and times with Wall Street bankers. He still shines the shoes of some of the biggest bankers on Wall Street. He's an immigrant from Brazil. Junior, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
We're good. Did you ever think?
Thanks for having me here.
It's great to have you. Did you ever think that your stories as the shoeshine guy were going to end up in the spotlight in a big book, optioned now by Warner Brothers for the movies, Junior?
Well, never had that thought in my life, and it's been really great, and it's just been an amazing experience for myself.
He's actually becoming quite a celebrity in Brazil. He was on the front page of Brazil's largest newspaper 2 weeks ago. And this Sunday, he's going to be on Brazil's most popular TV show. It's called, what's it called?
Fantastico. It's like fantastic.
Brazilian Idol.
They're doing a big segment on him. So this is pretty dizzying.
That's great. Junior, you know, here's this book, and it's got all kinds of juicy, you know, money, greed, cocaine, Russian strippers, supermodels. Is that really the world you've seen?
It's been an amazing experience, like, going to a trading floor and shining the trading shoes. It took them a while for them to start like looking up to me and start doing a lot of good things for me. It took more than a year. I used to go there. I still go there and I shine trader shoes, and I still treat them in the same way. Even though like they think that I'm a celebrity now, I don't see myself as a celebrity.
He actually invited 12 of the – Graydon Carter gave us a great publication party at the Waverly Inn here in New York. And Junior invited 12 of the traders from the firm to come to the party. So he's sort of out of the closet now about his participation in the book. And you said the traders are enjoying it, right? They're reading it?
Well, I really didn't know what could happen, like – you know, I was not a big, big book reader. And when Doug asked me to do a book, to me, everything was so new. I never heard about a story like that in my life. Like, who wants to do a book about someone that smells people's feet every day, you know?
Right.
Because that's what I do. Like, that's what I'm about to do when I leave the show.
Yeah,
I'm going to go back there and shine everyone's shoes. Like, it haven't changed for me. But, yeah, it's been pretty crazy when the traders now, they get the book and they go like, hey, can you sign this book? And wait a minute, is this story about me and this story about that lady? And wow, my wife bought the book and she be reading the book at home saying that these parts are all about me. And I'll go like, well, no, I was not the one that wrote the book.
It's some pretty crazy stuff. And you end up describing time out in Greenwich, Connecticut, the mansions there, families that, traders, families that, one of them named a child Lucifer as there's a kind of, you know, talk about devil take the hindmost. But Murillo, Junior, let me ask you. You've got up close and personal kind of intimate time with these people when they don't have their game face on necessarily. Mm-hmm. These people have a lot of the wealth of the country and the world in their hands. Are they good people?
They are. They probably made my life what I have now. A dream that I never thought of in my whole life. If I was growing up in Brazil, I wouldn't have the same opportunity which I have in this country. And it takes them a while. It's all about trust. And if you could show it to them that you go there, you know, you don't do anything bad and you respect them in the way they want, you know, if they ask you to get coffee, you go get coffee. Anything that they ask you for, like to help them out. Like I had people that asked me to go over their house and trying to clean the backyard and the basement and stuff like that. I was always up to for that. So I think like the more you do for them, the more they like trust you and the more they kind of bring into their world.
They've got billions. You don't. Does it? First of all, how did you feel about that? And did you have the feeling that they are not just for you who they got to know, but in general, are they looking out for the little guy? Do they care about, you know, little investors across the country?
I don't know.
Well, there's one little paragraph in the book. It's very short. Yeah. I wanted to read it.
Please.
And this was actually one that's directly out of his mouth. Some passages in the book are virtual transcription. Mm. And this goes, "The traders, they treat me like I was as good as anybody. That's when I begin to respect myself, because anybody can learn to dress nice, speak nice, but the difference between a person that shines the shoes and a rich guy is not how the person behaves, it's how the person treats you." When I wrote that paragraph, and it sounded familiar to me, and I went back to Shaw's Pygmalion, and Eliza gives that exact speech, and the only difference is the difference between, you know, shoeshine and flower girl.
but of course, Robin, give us some perspective here. I mean, the other angle that we hear all the time from this part of the financial world is, if you don't have money, big money, you're nobody.
Mm. Yeah, look, these guys, though, they have an ample amount of ego. And on that trading floor, they love to flex that ego and show it off to people. And yes, within all of that greed and avarice, there is altruism. And again, I'm not describing all of finance and Wall Street as a monolith here, but it is pretty much a monolithic culture. It's a male testosterone monolithic culture. A lot of these guys aim for the same trophy wives. They are envious of one another come bonus season. And they actually, in my experience as a reporter, they long to dish out this stuff off the record because there's no other conduit. There's no other pressure valve for them to give these things away in confidence, in slightly veiled confidence. So in that respect, Gil was at a very lucky position of trust with these people.
So tell it to the shoeshine boy. Tim is calling from Lawrence, Massachusetts. Tim, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I used to work on the street for a few years and quit last year, actually. And I think there are a few good people on the street, but I've run into quite a few scumbags. And a lot of these people, it's just about the trade. So, you know, Gil going to get coffee, that is part of their trade. And that's kind of how they view life, really. You know, that's just their perspective. But
What makes a scumbag on Wall Street?
Well, it's you run into it every day. You kind of run into somebody who will tell you one thing and then do the complete opposite,
There's,
you know, 2 minutes later.
So. And why are you out of there, Tim? Last year, things were still pretty good. Why'd you leave?
I want to be an actor, so. I decided it wasn't for me, and, you know, I wanted to go out and see what else was going on in the world and tried a few different courses, and I'm still looking for it.
Got it. Tim, thanks for your call. Doug Stump, can any mortal person and ordinary moral conscience survive the temptations? I mean, after all, in your book, Confessions of a Shoeshine Boy, these are insider traders. They're gaming fast and furious, and illegally for that matter.
Yeah, there's plenty of that in the book, certainly. I like to stress the good because everybody else stresses all the sex stories and the drug stories.
You wrote them.
I did. There's a lot of those stories. I mean, obviously, there's the bad guy in the book is a scumbag, as that guy would say. And the way I created that character was Junior, over 4 years, he would tell me of, you know, this bad story or this mean story. There'd be like 100 different people. But I put all those stories together to make the bad guy in the book. And then same with there's a lot of sex talk on Wall Street. And I have one character in the book that's sort of sex obsessed. So every time Junior would tell me a story like, oh, this guy went out and cheated on his wife and then bought her some jewelry or whatever. He actually worked at 4 different firms. So I would take all those stories and I put that together as the sex guy in the book. You know, these are all kind of archetypes.
Hey, Junior, why is everybody talking sex so much on Wall Street? Is it just to relieve the pressure or something else?
Well, I think when you make a lot of money on life, what else is there for you to do? You got a beautiful wife, and most of the traders, they got more than 3 kids. So to them, it's like, you know, they already conquered the world. And they always, like, I think when you're a guy, you kind of have your wife and your kids, but then you want something to make you distracted.
Don't forget that he's Brazilian.
Right? Yeah,
that's a very Brazilian view.
Well, yeah, that's my Brazilian view.
Maybe he said in the book, we don't have that marriage-y lifestyle.
That marriage-y lifestyle. What about women traders? Not nearly as many, I know, but there's some pretty racy scenes in Doug's book, Junior, where you're shining shoes from the floor up with some of the gals. What's it like to be a female trader, from your observation, Junior?
I can see that they are very, some of them are tense, and they always trying to be very serious, and they always trying to show the traders that they could be just like them. But the traders doesn't really like when a woman is kind of like smarter than they are. So like the way you said, it's not that many women in the trading floor. If you go to like the trading floor which I work on, it's probably 600 people, and the percentage of women there must be like 15.
Maybe at best.
Maybe
let's get
less.
A call from
15 women.
No, I mean 15% of
15%,
women.
Yeah.
Okay. Doug, he's learned his percentages. He, after all, is a Wall Street.
He's a very smart kid.
Right. Chloe's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Chloe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a big fan of your show, and amidst all this talk of money, I'm wondering about proceeds. And my question is, how is profit sharing worked out between the shoeshiner and the author of the book?
Hey,
and I'll be happy.
We're equal partners.
Is that right? Whatever you make in the book and in the option to movie.
Yeah,
50-50.
In fact, he may end up with more.
Hey, you know, that's heartwarming. I'm glad. Straight up from the very beginning, was that the deal?
Always. I mean, one of my main goals in writing this book, he's a dear friend. He's a Brazilian son I never had at this point. So one of my goals in it, too, is to solve the educational problems and give him a better life.
Hey, terrific. Chloe, thanks for the question. I'm glad we got that on the record. Let's get a call from Beaufort, North Carolina. Sam, you're on the air.
Hi, not to get too more listening or anything about to sell, but I've got an MBA. I'm not involved with investments.
Okay.
But I'm wondering, in the old days, we used to hear that all this Wall Street stuff was actually an efficient market and for the economic good and so on and so on.
Right.
And the quant thing seems to be like a total casino moving up, down, sideways. Seems to have nothing to do with the economic kind of commonwealth of the nation, the world, or anything. It kind of makes me scared. I was wondering if they ever think about that at all, about the reality out there and what their kind of betting might, how that might toss the rest of the economy.
Yeah, thanks very much. Robin, let me come to you with that. You know, the market being woke six ways to Sunday and the context now woven around it by private equity work and the hedge fund guys. You know, Sam's got an MBA and he's wondering if it still works as that efficient market maker that we're told economies depend on.
You know, it still does, and I can tell you, I've said this on your show before, Tom, but if you were to have Jim Simons or any of these really powerful hedge fund private equity people appear on air and ask the question that your listener just asked, they'd say, we are the creative destroyers. We are the ones there who amass capital, who take risk, who get our you-know-what's handed to us in bad times, but live to see another day, ideally, to pounce on the opportunities on the upside. And we expedite what happens in the economy otherwise. We do offer that efficient distribution of capital. In fact, we are the ones who accelerate that process. And, you know, that much could be so much, you know, Gordon Gekko bloviating in front of the board of directors. Mm-hmm. But I guarantee you that's the way they see it. And, of course, Wall Street is happy to cater to it. And let's not be so high and mighty here. A lot of pension funds are the biggest customers of hedge funds. A lot of the institutions that cater to teachers, to academics, to unions out there are out there looking for returns, for better risk-adjusted returns, and they shovel money in the direction of hedge funds.
But you heard our trader, John, earlier in the hour saying now they are praying for and counting on the Fed bailing them out. And if they don't, the losers are a lot of little people in those pension funds as well. So, you know, a lot of high-rolling risk here. Maybe it brings efficiency, but is the risk really fairly shared, Robin?
Well, it's interesting this week. Hedge funds, by and large, allow in qualified institutional investors, people typically with at least $1 million to invest. Mm-hmm. And they effectively had margin calls. You want to talk about the tables turning and the dot-com meltdown. The little guy had the margin calls and had to liquidate all the positions in his portfolio to pay for, you know, the crap that he bought on margin. Mm-hmm. This time around, the hedge funds are being served with margin calls because they were knee-deep in sophisticated mortgage-backed securities, which are worth a fraction of their value. So they have to sell legitimate positions, companies that actually have really great balance sheets. Nothing's wrong with them. In theory, and probably in practice, if we see it over the next few weeks, the little guy should benefit from this. If the little guy has been averaging into this market, then we have one of those once in a 5-year windows where the hedge funds lose and the little guys win. So I think the verdict is still out.
Let's go to the little guy who's made this story possible, Murillo Jr. If you come away from this with a stack of bills, with some real bank, with some money, are you going to put it into the stock market?
Not at this moment. But one thing I could say is the traders are really working hard. Like, instead of just being playing games on the computer on Friday afternoon.
Yeah. Well, they used to play games, but not now.
Well,
not right now.
No, they're very serious people, but there are times that, you know, they have their little times free and they like be, you know, reading the newspaper or talking to each other. But now they're really serious and focused. Like, even my business went down a lot, like shiny shoes.
No time even for a shine. Doug, we just got 20 seconds. What's the moral of your story? Go ahead, America, put your money in the market, or watch out.
No, I think the moral of my story is, like, I think every person deserves respect, and quite often the janitors, shoeshine boys, don't get the respect they deserve and aren't treated as the valuable people that they are.
Well, here's one who may do well out of a wild story. Junior, thank you for joining us today. Good luck with Doug Stump and the book.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you.
The book is Confessions of a Wall Street Shoeshine Boy, and Robin Farzad at Businessweek magazine, thanks as always for your perspective.
Thanks, Tom.
Happy trading, everybody, and good luck. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.